Hi, I'm Jesse Hirsch. Welcome to the Future Herd. Here's something I think about a lot. We all eat, every single day, ideally multiple times a day. And yet most of us have almost no idea what's actually shaping the choices we make. We think we're just grabbing groceries. We think we're just feeding our families. But what if the whole system? The store layout, the packaging, the advertising, the ownership structures behind the brands. What if all of it is doing something to us that we've never really stopped to examine? That question is exactly why I wanted to talk to today's guest. Alyssa Overend is a sociologist at McEwen University in Edmonton, and she works at this genuinely fascinating intersection of food, health, media, and power. She didn't set out to study food. She started in sports, then followed a thread through health research. And it was her interview subjects themselves who kept pulling her back to food, over and over, unprompted and spontaneous. That kind of moment, when the evidence tells you where to look, is the mark of a top-tier researcher, one worth paying attention to. And what Alyssa brings to the conversation about food is something the agri-food sector doesn't always get to hear from. A critical eye trained on the social life of food. Not just what we eat, but what our food says about who we are, who has power, who gets left out, and how the stories we're told by industry, by media, by the grocery store itself, quietly shape what we believe is true. And in a moment when food security is rising, when consolidation is reshaping who controls our food supply, which of my dogs is going to yell during an intro, and when Canadians are paying more attention than ever to what's on their plates and where it comes from. That perspective feels urgent, and Harriet, my Bernadoodle, agrees. So what does a sociologist see when she walks into a grocery store that the rest of us are missing? Let's find out. Alyssa, welcome to the Future Herd.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Now, I like to start every episode with what I call my Rorschach test question, which bluntly is, what does the future mean to you?
Oh, that is a bit of a black hole some days, and maybe more optimistic one some days. You know, I think the future is what we make it. I think the future is what we hope it will be or imagine it to be. And the future is also totally unknown. I think some of the things that we see now will continue, and other things that we can never imagine will find their way, and we'll deal with them. So it's a bit of a known and a bit of the unknown.
Right on, right on. Fantastic answer. And in terms of your research interests, I mean, you cross a number of different subjects, a number of areas that I'm quite eager to not only get into, but connect in terms of the larger big picture. But I do like to kind of use my follow-up question as a kind of lore or origin frame. And in your case, it kind of feels that while you do have, like, I do want to talk methodology, for example, like qualitative methodologies is an area I've always been fascinated by. But how did food end up being one of the through lines of the different types of research that you have done and continue to do?
Yeah, great question. And it's clear you've done your research too. I started out actually, and I tell this to students a lot in sort of first and second year courses, and maybe this links to my answer about the future. I think a pattern emerges over time on our kind of career trajectories, if that's what we want to call them. But very few people have a career that's sort of a straight line from point A to point B. I started out in sports studies. They always say study something you know. And I was interested in sort of equity around sport and sociology of sport, which I didn't even know was a topic in high school and found it in university. So I followed that through my MA. And then I made perhaps a conscious decision at one point. Sport was something I loved. And the more you study something, you also see, you know, there's equity issues in sport and gender inequity and racial inequality and all the stuff around trans rights and all of this. And And sort of, I think I wanted sport to just be this happy place that I escape to. It was also somewhat strategic. You know, I think as a grad student, the question, especially in the humanities, is like, what are you going to do with this? And there was a lot more opportunity availability in health. There seemed to be more health funding. So I made the shift from sports studies to food stud or sorry, from sports studies to health studies. And it was actually a question in my PhD research. I studied undefined illness. So people that had an illness but couldn't get a medical diagnosis. And I was interested in sort of broader critiques of Western medicine and some of these things, which I think, you know, Western medicine does some things very well, but chronic pain, chronic illness, they're pretty bad at it. And I was asking people how they made sense of their illness. I didn't specifically go in asking about food. And almost verbatim, every interview, people were telling me detailed, thoughtful accounts about how they used food to manage this undiagnosed, undefined illness. And that's ultimately what kind of kicked me into food studies. It was around the same time that the dairy industry, I don't know, many of you may remember this, they did a Got Enough Milk campaign, and they were using milk or billboards that said, fight colorectal cancer and drink milk. And as a critical, you know, media studies or a critical intake of information, I'm like, wait a second, this is actually like pretty false information. And that's what sort of got me down the road of sort of food politics. So that's a long-winded answer to say I bumped around a bit, I followed interesting threads, and then really just as the connections, I still define myself as a health sociologist, but I do have a specialization in food. Because to me, you can't separate health and food. They're really one and the same.
And it's a great narrative because it speaks to how the researcher really listens to the evidence. And it kind of led you on this path of not only, looking at, to your point, the chronic health people, but also the media space, because both, I think, are part of a symbiotic relationship of how people think about food and think about their health. And I agree. I previously would never have thought about the sociology of sport, although it is an area that is gaining quite a bit of ground. But you're also the first guest that I could say, well, what is the sociology of food? Because I think that is an area that, again, while it does have quite a bit of scholarship to it, I suspect a lot of people in the agri-food sector may not have heard of it or may not be familiar with the area of study. And the kind of insights and the kind of value that it provides to how we think about our food value chain, not to mention, taking care of everyone in a society.
Yeah, you know what? I get that question a lot, Jesse. So what is sociology for people that don't know, or what is sociology of sport or of food? I think when we think about food, we've been taught to think about it in really sort of biochemical ways. And you see this a lot in the side of packaging information. So whether we're looking at food to what's in it, the ingredients, the percentage of daily intake, and calories, and these sorts of things. And we've sort of tipped very far to a kind of scientific understanding of food. And that's certainly there. We need food to survive, and obviously we understand the effects of fiber and vitamin C and all of the craze around protein and other nutrients. But food is, of course, also not just biochemical or scientific, it's very social. And I think most people can relate to that when you think of your favorite, you know, your comfort food or your favorite food. It's often a family food or a food that brings you back to childhood or a cultural food that you have pride in making or that you've learned from often your grandmothers or mothers, though not exclusively, or a food that's used only in particular times of the year. And so I think it brings us into the social very, very quickly. We also know that food can link to identity, whether you're looking again, cultural identity. There's been a lot written on the links sort of between masculinity and meat, and the assumption that if you eat vegetables or a vegetarian, that it's more feminized. So I think there's ways in which the social is always coded onto food. Right now, with the rising rates of food insecurity, food also links us to class inequality and poverty, and sort of who gets to eat well, quote unquote, in this day and age. Food links us to the environment, so how much food we waste, how we understand where food comes from, how it grows, our connections to the land, to composting systems, et cetera, and so forth. So as a, you know, I'm in a sociology department, but I would say I'm an interdisciplinary scholar. And to me, when you pick up any food item, whether it's coffee or bananas or your favorite bread, you can kind of pull a bunch of different threads from that one item. And if we pause to think about it, you know, how did that cup of coffee arrive and what are the politics of sort of food? So it can link us to those sort of more globalized questions. It can also link us to very personal questions. You know, and there's also links around food and disease, as I've mentioned, or food disorders or anorexia, bulimia, those types of things. So, you know, we could talk in circles for a long time about the connections between food and the social. That's my medium length answer on that one.
Which I say, challenge accepted, in no small part because the way you describe it, perhaps self-evident to you because you get to play in this playground all the time in terms of drawing the connections between food and culture and economics and politics. And what strikes me as fascinating to this, and I'll phrase this in a form of a follow-up, is I think on the one hand, the social dynamics of food are self-evident because of how we eat and who we eat with and what we choose to eat. But the way you described it, I think for the individual would require a level of self-awareness I think most people don't have. Or I'll even be more critical, that I think the industry doesn't want to imagine that people have. Like they like to imagine that consumers are kind of dumb, that they don't know where their food comes from, that they make decisions purely on prices. But you're describing research that goes much deeper than that and speaks to a kind of intersectionality of how these decisions are made. So if I could take that rambling and throw it into kind of a question, what role does media play in all of this? Because you alluded earlier, you're sort of a lens as a critical media scholar, or at least someone who likes to entertain that dynamic. You've described food because you have the benefit of being an interdisciplinary researcher, but I think most people experience food through media, through advertising. I'd love to hear your thoughts on that, or the kind of research or the way it impacts your research in terms of the media culture around food that fundamentally impacts our social, let alone our political economy around food. I got to shut up. I'm rambling. Please bail me out.
No, I love it. I love it. There's definitely a couple threads I could pick up on. You know, I immediately come to the sort of government regulations around advertising. And you know, in this day and age, there are none. But at a certain point in history, we did see regulations around what could be advertised to kids, particularly in the little commercial blocks between their favorite shows. And I believe it was the Nixon era in the US. And as Canadians, we like to see ourselves as very different from the US, which in some important ways, I also like to think we are. And let's hold on to that. But also, we are the largest importer of American television. And so there's a lot more overlap in our culture. We can also see how much, even, you know, from our childhood, how many American stores have entered Canada through that in the last Canadian-US-Mexico agreement. So the update on the 1980s NAFTA agreement, we also see American products entering. And so there's a lot more blurring and fluidity between American food and Canadian food that I think most people realize. And going back to that advertising, the Nixon era did lift regulations. And so if you ever watch kids' shows or for whatever reasons, you will see a lot more advertising. And that tends to be around things like sugary cereals, which if you look at the front of box advertising, is also a form of media. And so we tend to think of media as this, you know, commercials. Most people don't consume it in that way. It may be pop-up ads. But the grocery store itself and packaging itself has become a form of an advertisement. And so a lot of the cereal companies, granola bars are another one, you know, flashy front of cover images, health claims, so made with whole grain oats, but then they're still chock full of sugar. So unless you're really going in with a fine tooth comb, and a lot of people aren't, grocery stores are kind of harried and people rush in and rush out. They're not meant to kind of linger. A lot of those sweetened cereals are also placed at sort of eye level manipulation for kids who come with their parents. And, you know, psychologists have shown time and time again that, you know, the more kids ask for a cereal, the parents will be like, okay, you can have your Cocoa Puffs or whatever it is that you've been seeing and that you have access to. So I think there's been a lot targeted towards kids. I watch some, you know, streamed shows, and you're starting to see ads in there, and it tends to be fast food. You never see an ad for an apple because we know those are healthy, and an apple never also has to say that it is healthy. It's just sort of assumed. We all know it is. So I think when you see products like granola bars that try a little too hard to say that they're healthy, there should be something that's sort of triggering to say, well, why are they trying to convince me so much of this? So I think that can be really skewing for people, especially when you get names that are themselves a form of advertising. So Nature's Valley or Honey and Oats, but it's actually sugar and oats, but honey's in there, it's just further down. So I think the sort of naming language and the package advertising is a really big form of media right now for food.
Well, and I'd love to hear you elaborate on the kind of grocery store as cultural environment, as media environment. And I say this because I experienced a little bit of cultural awareness around that when I moved from the city to where I now live in rural Eastern Ontario. Because in the city, my grocery experience was as you described. It was in and out as quick as possible. I had the whole place mapped. I knew exactly which products I wanted. It was a very strategic operation. Versus now, not only do I go slow because I'm researching, right? I'm looking at all the food. I'm kind of paying attention to how inventory moves because I'm interested in this stuff. But it's also a social space. It's a third space. Like, I watch neighbors connect. I watch, you know, people have these social interactions. Like, it's a different vibe. And I'm sure there's a spectrum of grocery experiences across the country. But my point is, it is a kind of cultural environment. It is a kind of media environment. And you kind of evoke that in your description. So I'd love for you to unpack that further. Because I didn't really think about it until you said it. I'm sure there's a lot of other people who take the grocery store really kind of for granted.
Yeah, it becomes this mundane part of living. You know, you just pop to the grocery store. But it is a very curated environment, not unlike an IKEA that has you kind of mazing around the store to see different things. And grocery stores are set up in a very particular way, and that's why we see them as somewhat consistent. So you tend to come into the fruit and vegetable aisle, bright colors, you get the sense of a kind of market. And I think your experience of rural grocery store reminds me more of a farmer's market. People do linger. They have a nice cup of coffee. They talk to the people about what's in season or what do you do with, you know, kale or eggplant or whatever it is that you're buying. And you run into neighbors and those types of things. It's a bit more leisurely. But the box stores that we're seeing today do not have that feel. You do see advertising in the store. I mentioned the front of packaging form of advertising, but there's also words around, you know, local, prices can't be beat. There's those types of subtle things that are also playing into, and maybe you don't kind of consciously pick them up, but you are aware of those things unconsciously as you're moving through the space. So the psychology of grocery stores tends to be around things like the size of the carts are massive. I was at a kind of larger store. I'm only 5'2", and this cart was so big, and they want that because they want you to be able to fill it. So there's this idea that, you know, the bigger the cart, the more you'll fill it. They want you to start at the fruit and vegetables because I think if you buy some healthy things, then you may, you know, go through the middle aisles, which tends to be more and more of those packaged things. And if you think back or look back, a lot of our grocery stores, and I don't have the exact statistic now, but it's, I would say, you know, 75% of the stuff that's in grocery stores is all that prepackaged globalized food, cereals, crackers, granola bars, pop, chips. And I remember chip aisles as a kid. I love potato chips. But there are whole aisles of potato chips now. It's sort of definitely sprouted. And yeah, you might get your bakery aisle and your meat aisle and the veggie, but a lot of it is sort of set up based on this idea of like buying some of those, what some people call pseudo foods. They're edible, but there's a lot of stuff in there that may not be great for us in large doses in the long haul. The music that's playing, the sort of deals, this idea that, you know, the sort of loyalty reward, so you continually go back to the same store. In part, I think, as you mentioned, like it's really disorienting going in a new store and you're like, I have no idea where anything is. So knowing where you're going, but also this idea that you might get, you know, little rewards or something kicked back. What else? Eye level manipulation. So the sort of eye level stuff, the end displays, pairing. So you'll often see chips and pop very close together. Again, that people will buy one and then need the other. So there's sort of a lot going on within grocery stores than most people realize.
And one of the things I've noticed as, again, someone who's now really paying close attention to not just how the grocery store I go to is configured, but how it changes, is on some levels, it does feel like a canary in the coal mine when it comes to food insecurity. And, you know, we've had a number of guests on the show recently as we've dug deeper into both sides, the food insecurity and what it would take to achieve food security. And, you know, we've been trying to sort of build a larger kind of knowledge base to understand the policy implications. But I'm curious, you know, from we've been talking about the grocery store, you know, initially as one of the ways in which it shapes people's perceptions of food and then the kind of media and cultural environment. But, you know, back to the interdisciplinary, what are the other signals or what are the other areas either in your research or the areas of research you pay attention to that kind of suggest grocery stores are a node, a metric in terms of helping to understand, you know, food insecurity and the larger ability as a society of whether we are feeding ourselves, feeding each other effectively?
Well, I think in a capitalist system, you have to look at ownership. And we've seen this in pharmaceuticals. So the large, you know, five manufacturers control a vast majority. We see that in media. So the big five of media control what stories are shared and what aren't, which is why, you know, small scale or grassroots local media programs are fantastic. And we also see this in food, and most people don't realize that. You know, in Canada, even the large five grocery stores control 80% of the market. And so some of those smaller mom and pop shops, which I think, you know, as you say, have a different feel or a different vibe. They tend to be more family owned. They tend to be smaller. They really can't compete. And so you see these large companies really buying out smaller ones. And we've seen that with the loss of some of those smaller stores. Also in terms of what happens outside the grocery store, you're starting to see, it wasn't that long ago in the history of Canada where more families farmed. And now, because of the politics of the way food is grown, it's very, very expensive. So things like monocropping, to be able to compete, you need large machinery. You also, you know, need to be connected to Monsanto products in some way. And that becomes very difficult. So a lot of smaller farms are going out of business to the point where we have very few Canadian farmers left. And you know, that might be okay in the immediate interim, but when we do see the large food system start to break down, which we have through the pandemic, that was a little bit of a warning sign. It's not a perfect system. We also see delays due to war, fuel. Anytime there are fuel increases, prices are intricately linked to that because our food comes from so far away. And so it actually doesn't make any sense to be bringing food from so far. We need to be really supporting food sovereignty movements, which are local, locally controlled, locally owned, community minded, and all of those things that grocery stores really aren't. And You know, one of the things that really gets my goat, I guess, about grocery stores, which I didn't mention in the last question, but came to me in this question, they do a lot of things with community. And you hear them saying, we donated all this money to the food bank or to Boys and Girls Clubs and these kinds of things. And they do that for PR largely. You even see that in some of their advertisements. You'll see, you know, Daryl or one of the owners in a family environment saying, you know, my family's like your family. But literally a lot of these owners are they're billionaires. They're making money off the fact that many people are still having a difficult time actually accessing food. So that sort of bothers me because I think people like the idea that food is a community or it is locally produced and locally grown. And I think some grocery stores may be making efforts to have some locally sourced products, but again, it comes back to the consumer to sort of look at the ads or the tags and say, you know, is this US produced or Canadian produced, and those types of things. So I think, you know, grocery stores make it very, very difficult for local food security and make it difficult for some of those local farms to really succeed. Although we are seeing a bit of an upswing in things like community supported agriculture and farmers markets and those types of things, in part because of taste. You know, I think that's one of the first things that consumers will say, and that the quality of particularly produce, you know, tomatoes, peppers, lettuce, to me, those things, they don't taste right a lot of the time when you buy them at a large store. They may have a long shelf life, but they taste kind of empty. And I mean, they're pulled or picked early and shipped for a long time. So they have lost a lot of that taste or value. And I think when you taste a farmer's market tomato, you're like, oh, it's so good. And I think people start to use that as a marker as well.
And relatedly, it does make me wonder if the kind of AstroTurf campaigns that dominate a lot of the Canadian grocery system, if they're just not as effective, because I do see people kind of dismissing them and even being derisive as a parallel to your point of that when you try food that is grown locally, that is, you know, coming from a different process, it tastes different. But let me take one step back before we take one step forward. I suspect that there are people listening who this is the first time they've heard the phrase food sovereignty. So I'd love for you to kind of give us a picture of what that could look like. And I mean this in the context of, say, what is often called the food value chain or the food supply chain. How would that look in a localized kind of food sovereign scenario?
So we hear food sovereignty in part around Indigenous food sovereignty or Black food sovereignty. So groups that have been especially vulnerable to some of the food shortages we've seen. The situation in Canada's north or remote communities is absolutely abysmal when it comes to food security. Decades of government not inaction, but sort of ill-guided action on foods, trying to promote store-bought or southern food. So that's, you know, I think the rates in many places in Canada's north are the highest rates of documented food insecurity in a developed country. And we have to remind ourselves that Canada is a wealthy nation. We are also a large exporter of quality food. So what is happening? And I think one of the key things that I like to instill in this day and age, it's not a lack of food. The global food system produces more food than we ever have, but half of that food or close to half of that food is wasted. It's thrown out. It doesn't get to where it needs to get to. So it's not that we have a lack of food. We have a lack of food access. And that gets us into some of these politics of sort of globalized food systems, the reliance on store-bought or prepackaged food, the removal from farming or more local food systems. So food sovereignty, sovereign is the sort of independent or more locally controlled food systems, has been a sort of hot topic in food studies for at least a couple of decades. It focuses on many sort of pillars or key values. So it prioritizes the right to food as a fundamental human right, not as this kind of resource to be extracted or sold for profit. Again, going back to some of those big five corporations, they are profiting on food, and food for the most part is grown within a fairly accessible system. Nature produces food almost as a gift. And if you come back to indigenous understandings of food, it is a gift. It's a gift from the land and it's a gift from the earth. And it's part of that reciprocal relationship that we should have. And I think grocery stores take us very far from that. It's very transactional. It's very devoid of any kind of exchange aside from an economic exchange. The other pillar of food sovereignty is that it values food providers. So those people that farm and harvest and hunt and those types of things have deep knowledge on how to do these things. And I think some of the craze around local gardening is bringing back some of that food knowledge. It localizes food systems. So again, that idea that it is a completely inefficient system to be bringing. I know in Alberta and Canada, we get a lot of our fruits and vegetables from Chile, from South Africa. These places are very, very far. And yeah, we can't grow all things. Coffee and tropical fruits and those types of things may always be something grown or flown in. But we can grow a lot of things. And so it's about rebalancing the things that we can do locally so that when we do see larger scale issues like war or pandemics or border closures and those types of things, is that we have our own food systems. We're not waiting at the border for these things, or they're not vulnerable to price increases and those things. The decisions are also made locally, so consumers have an active part in their food systems, unlike we see with the grocery store. Building food skills and knowledge, so getting people more connected to the values of food, to the values of growing, and sharing that knowledge intergenerationally. And then finally, that connection with nature. I touched on this a little bit, like the inefficiencies, but there's a huge invisible cost. And yeah, the grocery store tomato might be 50 cents cheaper than the one at the farmer's market. But I think as grocery store prices increase, we're starting to see those things more on par. But the problem is that there are a lot of invisible costs, largely environmental ones, that go into bringing that food from, you know, thousands of kilometers away, the pesticides that are used in that, often the plastic packaging, the food waste. Grocery stores will purposely overbuy, and they like particular shapes and sizes, which apparently is consumer demand. So they'll throw out sort of misshapen or ugly vegetables, and that has huge environmental costs as well. So the sort of traditional farms that the old McDonald farms, where there are some animals, some vegetables, those kinds of things are very, very good for the land. The large monocropping practices are terrible, whether you're looking at canola, soy, wheat, almonds in California, any of these, avocados in Chile, they're terrible for ecosystems because they're not an ecosystem. They're a monocrop, and they're bad for bees, and they're bad for pollinators. They're bad for the soil, etc. And I think there's a lot of those things that people don't realize is part of that price point.
And this is, you know, as host, where I'll validate what you're saying and anticipate there may be some people in the audience who are triggered by some of the connections and arguments you're currently presenting. But there is a voluminous amount of research that substantiates all the things you're saying. That speaks to my next question. And this question's a bit of a paradox. Because on the one hand, the industry that exists right now loves to use the word collaboration, both as kind of proof that what they're doing is what should be done, but also as like a vision for the future of their industry. Whereas you were just describing a level of collaboration, a level of cross-sectoral collaboration, a level of eater and producer and everyone at the table level of collaboration that perhaps conceives of collaboration in a much different way than the industry potentially frames it. I'd love for you to address that. And you could address it perhaps along the lines of, and maybe this gets us to the qualitative research methodologies part of the show, which I will be getting to later. How does that collaboration happen? How do we facilitate the level of participation in our food system that a food sovereignty kind of requires, enables. Again, I'm gushing, but I think there's a lot of insights here for the people who really do believe in collaboration. So please help me out.
Yeah, I'll go a side route and then I'll come back to your question. When you think about the history of food guides in Canada, to me, that's an obvious example of how industry colludes with the government. So if you look back to the food guides of the 90s and the early 2000s, well, what features prominently, again, are those sugared cereals, dairy, ice cream was sort of actually featured visually in the 1992 edition, which is like how absurd that ice cream, while it's delicious, it's not necessarily, a kind of healthy food product. So there's been a history of, and literally when the food guide people met, there'd be members of industry. There'd be someone from the dairy lobby, someone from the meat lobby, sitting literally at the table and devising sort of the colored bands. And you can see over time that the shifting evidence of this it is not static because it's political. And at one point, you know, the grains, we were to eat all of this, I can't remember exactly, like 8 to 12 servings of grain in a day, which is an enormous amount of grain. And you can see that as sort of the industry influencing. In the most recent 2019 food guide, it was the first time they actually collaborated with dietitians, with nutritionists, with food scientists, and industry was not there. And what do we see? There were some controversies around the guide, but it was a much more whole foods. So there weren't any grocery store products. It was whole grains, whole foods. Meat was there, but it wasn't so centralized. Dairy was there, but it wasn't so centralized. That those things can be part of a diet, but they shouldn't be your predominant diet. So I think it's usually easier to look historically at the way these things have happened in formal collaboration. And then in terms of currently where we're seeing shifts around collaborations towards more equitable food systems. So some of those food systems change, alternative food networks. There's some great organizations. I'll give a shout out to Food Secure Canada, who do a lot of work collaborating with Indigenous communities, the government, with dietitians, with food organizations to really address the multitude of these issues. The Right to Food Canada is another organization, and they just hosted a conference, I want to say in Ottawa, but somewhere in Ontario, last weekend, and there were over 450 alternative food networks at the table, or many tables, talking about these issues. In some of the work that I've done on alternative food networks, I emerged with the question of, like, we know things like farmers markets and food forests and seed exchange exist, but they seem to be more prevalent. And I was sort of interested in, like, what's there and how many are there? And there's a ton of them. If people just even scratch the surface of their communities, I think a lot of people will find community gardens, will find seed exchanges, will find people that are passionate about these. And, you know, I know even cities have done some urban food forests. So planting edible trees, it makes a lot of sense if people are hungry, rather than planting a decorative tree, plant an apple tree. And then you can help feed people really healthy and nutritious things. So I think those collaborations are happening in all kinds of ways. And I think Indigenous communities have long done stuff around food. I think we do see anti-poverty movements also long doing things around food. But those two organizations, Food Secure Canada and the Right to Food, are both really central in kind of bringing together a lot of those collaborations and communities currently.
Let me use that then to ask a kind of two-part or a dual-pronged question. I mean, given what you've said, do you think that the current discourse around, like, municipal grocery stores or public-owned grocery stores, like, do you think that's aiming too low in the sense that it's still imagining food delivery via the grocery store? And maybe we should be thinking about even, you know, more original concepts, which begs the second part, you know, what are the kinds of initiatives? What are the kinds of, you know, interventions even that you think communities could be focusing on and organizing on as awareness around the concept of food sovereignty starts to build and grow?
Yeah, those are great questions. I love your first question of whether community grocery stores or cooperative grocery stores or publicly funded grocery stores is too low. And I wish we lived in a world where that is too low of a bar, but I think we've become so dependent on grocery stores. And I hear this, I see it in students' eyes. I say something about grocery stores, and I don't think we're at a point where we'll get rid of grocery stores, particularly, as I said, for things that we can't grow here in Canada. We do have a limited growing season, and I think we're dependent on all kinds of things like coffee. Although we could roast it locally, we can't grow it locally. So I think, I always say, let's not start that far. That stresses people out. Let's just tip the scales a little bit. We can all grow food, and this comes to your second question. The best thing we can all do to take a little bit of some of those big, sticky, scary issues around the environment, around food security, around food sovereignty, around politics, etc. We can all grow food, some people more than others. And I know that time poverty is a thing. And I know that having access to land is a thing and access to tools, absolutely. But I think, whether you're looking at herbs in a window box, herbs are really expensive. And the grocery store sells them in these massive amounts. You often need a tablespoon of dill, but you're buying, like what seems like a large amount, and then you either dry it or it goes to waste. Last summer, I did a bit of a garden and I just did lettuce. Lettuce grew all summer. I didn't buy one clamshell, plastic clamshell of lettuce. So it's not a huge thing. But I'm only one person, and if we all did a little bit, I also think that growing food really connects you to neighbors. The amount of times that, you're like, I have an extra zucchini, and that will foster a dialogue or a connection to community. So I think all of that in small doses brings us back to the roots of food and the roots of community. I looked a little bit at public grocery stores, and actually the United States have been doing it, and they do it on military bases, and it saves those people like 25 to 30%. And I'm like, that's, again, it's not the magic bullet solution. There are no magic bullet solutions, but it helps. And 25% on groceries, I think right now people would say, heck yes, like that is a good chunk of money. And the fact that they've already been doing it, but for a very sort of select few, does show that there is some promise there. During the pandemic, food security actually went down. So we had a little, it was climbing right before, and then in 2021, it went down because people were getting a version of a universal basic income. And there's been research upon research that shows, there's been pilot studies that when you give people money to feed themselves, they actually do better. And they can feed themselves in the way that suits them, that fits their cultural diets, their personal preferences, etc. So I think that's another way that politically we could be looking to address food security. And in terms of those other things, some of my work or research has sort of uncovered not only the abundance of things like food or community-supported agriculture, farmers markets are popular. And if you go there on a Saturday or a Wednesday, there's people there, and that's a good sign. I think people are really valuing that. I think a lot of libraries have done some good work in things like seed banks. There's also some community organizations that do things like tool sheds, where you can, get those tools for free. Free workshops, obviously, you can learn a lot about gardening on YouTube and the internet. So we don't need a lot to be able to grow. The seed itself is the magic. We just sort of foster it. Food pantries, food co-ops, food hubs, urban farms, food forests, these are all some of the things that have already been going on. And I think people just need to sort of look up and say, what else or what part of my food could I be getting elsewhere? And I think it's a lot of little things add up. I don't think social change is necessarily easy or overnight, but I do think of it like a kind of you kind of attack it from a multiple angle. And there's actually some good discourse. I think people are fed up with grocery stores right now. Not only did we see the bread price fixing scandal, where grocery stores purposely fix bread prices only by 10 cents, but again, it made for millions of dollars. And to me, that shows if we're not all buying our herbs or our lettuce or our tomatoes or carrots or other things we can grow, it's a little bit of money out of their pocket. They also got busted last week with a meat scandal as well. So misweighting the meat and pricing it at a different price point. So these are criminal activities, and they continue to do this, even though their profits are very, very high. So I think people are miffed about that. And I think you do get, maybe it's idyllic, but a very different experience in some of these other food systems. And not just about food. I think people are also lonely or isolated or disconnected. A lot of us live far away from families, so our community becomes some of that. And I think food does, you know, you meet your neighbors when you're out gardening and you talk about things and you try to offload your extra zucchini. And that fosters a relationship too. Anyway, so
even better. I was going to say, or even better, invite them over for a meal and bond over food, which is another ancient cultural practice. Now, I, you know, as we start to get to the close of any episode, I usually like to sort of make open-ended questions to, you know, allow the guests to go in directions that maybe I didn't anticipate. And in your case, I'm doing it a little earlier, except my question is a little more focused, which when I was researching yourself and your research interests, I was very much fascinated by not just the range of areas, but the way in which you connect them all. So to articulate that in the form of a question, are there other areas of your research or research interests that either connect to food or that you think is relevant to the very enjoyable conversation we're having today? Only because I could listen to you for quite a bit longer. So I'd love to hear you connect the stuff we've been talking about to some of the other research areas that, you know, capture your curiosity.
Well, thanks for the question. I appreciate that. My brain's often sort of thinking about all kinds of things, food related and equity related. I think food ultimately is about equity, and that's why I think there's some interesting conversations around it. You know, and I use students a lot as a kind of gauge for the public discourse, rightly or wrongly. But I hear students say a lot, well, you know, they'll go to Walmart or they'll go to Loblaws or Superstore because they're cheaper. And I'm like, I don't know if that's true anymore. And it could be for some things like beef. I think the grass-fed beefs and those things that you get at the farmers markets or CSAs are a little more expensive. They're better quality, but they are more expensive. But for some of those other things, I'm not sure. So part of me thinks about doing some kind of price point analysis of farmers markets compared to grocery store items on things like basics, you know, potatoes, carrots, tomatoes, whatever, lettuce, those kinds of things. And I think people be surprised that I think they're actually more on par than they were 10 years ago. So that's sort of something. I'm not an economist by any stretch, but I think I wanna actually look into that. I've been doing work in an education environment on something called universal design, which comes out of the disability studies and disability equity movements. Universal design is setting up a physical space that's accessible to a wide range of users, including those with mobility aids, so walkers and wheelchairs and so forth, but that they're also accessible to an athlete that might have had a knee injury or an elderly person or a parent who's carrying a bunch of kids and groceries and all the things that parents carry. It's been used in education to make the learning environment more accessible. So rather than just, you know, talking or putting up slides, is that you have different ways of presenting information. And so I've actually used documentaries, podcasts, those types of things. And there's so many about food. There's so many great podcasts and documentaries about food because I think it's something everyone's sort of coming around to. So I may also be using some of your episodes in my courses, but just to get people to engage in different ways. So I've been doing that in the classroom for a long time, different forms of assessment. So getting students to do tests and assignments, but also more creative ones. Map a grocery store system. Map how your coffee came from the field to your front door. Like, I think that's an interesting assignment, and you can get people to display information in different ways. But of course, these two somewhat disparate fields are connected because one of the groups vulnerable to food insecurity are disabled populations. You know, the cuts that we've seen towards disability funding, the inaccessibility of many food environments. And one of the things that has come up in my research on alternative food networks, as I've been sort of, I am a qualitative researcher, but this last project, the last year, has been a kind of content analysis. So it's quantitative light, but looking at what are the features of alternative food networks. And actually one just came out in the Canadian Food Studies Journal on Alberta. And I'm using that as a template to look across Canada. I'm curious to see what do food, like, are there more in Nova Scotia than there are in Ontario? Like, what are the sort of differences? So I'm using a quantitative study to eventually narrow down some qualitative questions. But in that, I'm also tracking how many of these alternative food networks have any kind of accessibility? And a lot of them don't. So that's something as a disabled person interested in food security. Can you go to a community garden? And many of them you can't. So I've been looking at some of that and sort of blending those two interests on disability and food insecurity.
Right on. And I'm very pleased to have learned of the concept of universal design, and will certainly spend my own interest getting into it, because I think part of the application, speaking as a farmer, is thinking about designing for animals and designing for mm-hmm. different forms of living systems in which the principles of universal design absolutely apply. Although, to your point, ensuring that these community food spaces are accessible does also seem like a kind of foundational level that they need to be operating on. I've been promoting the qualitative methods part of our episode the entire time, partly for a couple of reasons. I am myself a qualitative researcher, a big fan of qualitative research. But I think a lot of the people in our audience, these are folks who work in the agricultural sector, usually on the association side, usually on the people side, the research side. They are also often engaged in qualitative research. And yet the paradox is, agriculture very much seems to fetishize quantitative research as if it is some divine voice, when in fact qualitative research offers quite a bit of value, especially in this world we live in where it's important to center the human in so many aspects. I'm rambling again. I would love to hear your thoughts on what's going on in the world of qualitative research, some of the key tips around the methodologies, and how you're feeling about the field and the practice. I mean, we're heading out towards the end of the episode here, so like you can go wherever you want, but I love qualitative methodology, so I figure this would be a good time to nerd out with someone, while at the same time keeping our audience in the loop.
My quantitative research colleagues will appreciate me saying that I think there's ultimately room for, we need both, right? We need both. We can't have one or the other. That's the balancing of the scales. But, you know, as a young graduate student, I went to some talk and it was very quantitative, and they did this whole presentation and they ended with this finding that said, you know, we've seen a 3% increase in something or other. And I was like, that's it? Like, why and how? And all of these questions that really can't be answered by quantitative research. So I think statistics play a part, but they don't tell the whole story. And they can be quite misleading at times as well without that context. So I think, you know, it's important to see, you know, we use statistics a lot to say food insecurity is on the rise. So we could gauge that anecdotally by talking to friends and family, or we can see that close to 10 million Canadians find themselves food insecure now. And that's a very, very high rates. And that sort of is the beginning point. So it's a punch. And then we can understand the how and the why of that through qualitative research. you know, we talk a lot about mental health issues lately. So 1 in 5 Canadians struggle with mental health issues. Again, the stat is important, but we've also seen a broadening of the definition. So more people fall under those definitions. We're also seeing less social systems. So all the social security stuff has been cut. Well, that would affect mental health issues. So I think they both are in conversation with one another, but I think for me, it's summed up in the, I think qualitative research starts where quantitative research often ends, in that there's been an up or a down, and then the qualitative research will look at more contextual questions on why that is and how that is. Even with the current research I'm doing, you know, I tell students, you have to let the research drive the type of methodology you use. So I want to look at, I want to see what's going on in alternative food networks across Canada. That would be very, very difficult to do qualitatively just because of the sheer number. At least 450, there's probably more depending on how you count them. So things like how we define topics, and then how we kind of go about that. So that's for me the sort of large mapping, and then the questions of like, okay, there's these ones that are doing really fantastic holistic food sovereign approaches. Let's interview those people rather than a sort of broad interview. So it can kind of focus your efforts. Interviews are a fantastic way. I think some site visits, like I'm really interested in going and seeing some of these alternative food networks in practice, because, you know, a website will indicate kind of their overview, but there's probably things that are happening, that sort of human piece that you talked about, that really can't be captured in a lab or in a survey. It's something bigger than that. There's a really good alternative food network, the Land of Dreams in Calgary, Treaty 7 territory. And they do work, the elder, an Indigenous Stoney elder, is the lead of the organization, but they do work with newcomers. And I think what a great merging, and what a great way to get newcomers to bring stories about food, and then connections around food, and then having elders and Indigenous folks sort of talk about the history of the land here. I think that's a beautiful thing. I'd love to see that in action. And I don't know, you might be able to capture bits of it in quantitative research, but I think the video and the voice and the human aspects are always going to be qualitative.
On. And really what I'm hearing as you describe that is, on the one hand, quantitative methods have allowed us to increase our capacity for complexity and understand complexity in our world, but that's useless without sense making, right? We need the why. We need to understand, and that is the role of the qualitative researcher. Our last question that we end on is kind of like the first, in that it's really open-ended, and it's the shout out. It's, you know, who are the leaders that you look up to that have inspired you? And it's, you know, not really meant to be like an Academy Awards where we're expecting you to list a whole bunch of names of your, you know, mentors and collaborators, but just a few kind of off the cuff people who you think the rest of us should be reading about and learning more about.
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm not always great at name recognition in the moment. So I'll say any Indigenous teachings in general or about food have been, for me, completely transformational. And not in some kind of checklist way, but in a really kind of heartfelt and deep sense. I think if people have opportunity to learn from a knowledge keeper or an elder, do it. There's something magical that happens in that. I think my critical food studies scholars, as an interdisciplinary scholar, I went to a lot of different conferences, and food studies scholars, they do conferences great because we're not just sitting in a room. We go out, we do farm tours, we do workshops on things. It's theoretically grounded, but it's also praxis-based. So I think there's been a lot of pioneers in Canada. Elaine Power's done work on universal basic income. Charles Levko's done a lot of work on alternative food networks. So some of the sort of founding members of food studies in Canada.
Both of which we've got booked on the podcast.
Oh, so good. That's great. Yeah. I love that.
That made me feel validated when you said that. Sorry, please go ahead.
No, they're both fantastic. And then a lot of the community people, like running a community garden and corralling adults and sending out all of that. I think the organizers, they do a lot of work, again, because they're not, no one's making millions off this, unlike the grocery stores, but they're doing it as a passion project and because there's something they get back from it, that community piece. So I think anyone who's leading community organizations, shout out and kudos to them.
Right on. And you've also, throughout our conversation today, have mentioned a number of organizations that both, you know, allow our listeners and us as a growing institutional knowledge to, you know, learn more about their work and start connecting it into what we're trying to do here at the Future Herd, which is map out a lot of this activity, you know, to the assignments you were giving your students in terms of understanding where their food comes from. Thank you, Alyssa. This has been fantastic. Welcome to the Future Herd. This is where I get to say we got to have you back. Part of what we're trying to do is build a kind of a larger conversation around food. And in particular, you've really helped introduce food sovereignty into our conversation, which will now be a recurring thread. Any final words before we conclude?
New Grocery Movement is an Edmonton-based organization. They're largely youth-driven. There are a lot of 30-year-olds and thinking about the future. They're fierce. They also have some connections in Toronto and Ontario, so I would shout out to them. Thanks to you for organizing the conversation and to the listeners for being part of it, and thanks for having me.
That closes another rousing, rowdy episode of The Future Herd. And I have to say that talking with Alyssa reminded me why I started this podcast in the first place. She has that rare ability to make you look at something you do every single day, buying food, eating food, thinking about food, and suddenly see it completely differently. The grocery store aisle, the front of a cereal box, the music playing on overhead. None of it is accidental, and Alyssa helps us understand why that matters, not just for individuals, but for communities, for equity, for the future of how we feed each other in this country. I mean, I like to say we're all designers now. We all have a sense of how our environments affect us and how we want to affect our environment. And that's why what I keep turning over in my head is something she said early on, that the future is both known and unknown. And that will deal with what finds its way to us. There's something quietly courageous about that framing, especially when you spend your career looking honestly at the harder edges of our food system, the way Alyssa does. That combination of clear-eyed critique and genuine openness, I think that's exactly the kind of thinking the agri-food sector needs more of right now. So thank you, Alyssa, for bringing your research, your stories, and your entire interdisciplinary mind to the Future Herd. It was a genuine pleasure. Now, if you want to dig deeper into the subjects that we cover here on the Future Herd, well, we got a website for you, thefutureherd.ca, in which we not only have the episodes we produce, but knowledge that we generate associated with each episode to dig deeper into the policy, into the research, into the ideas. We've also got a near-daily intelligence brief that gives you a heads-up on what's going on in the sector and the world. And, of course, our comments platform that looks to get your input, your perspective on the issues we cover. And if this conversation has meant anything to you, well, I'd love you to share it with your friends, with your dogs, with anyone you think wants to engage their food and our food system more directly. Well, that's it for me and Harriet. Thanks again. We'll see you guys soon.